Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Flicks of Doom, the official movie podcast for geeksofdoom.com. This is our first episode for the new year, 2011. And to join me on this episode, the wonderfully talented, lanky, and lovely Mr. William Goodman from geeksofdoom.com. Mr. Goodman, how you doing?
I'm doing well, Justin. How are you?
Pretty good, pretty good. I received a butt dial from Mr. Goodman last night, so that I woke up to that in my inbox this morning.
Yeah, what was that message like? I bet it was just a lot of loud jazz music.
Well, it was you and it seemed like a female companion trying to find some place. You were giving her directions.
Oh, yes. We were leaving. We went to a very, very nice place in my local city. It was the bar was named Speakeasy, and it was essentially if they had taken a bar that you would find in New York City in the time of Mad Men and put it in the middle of downtown Columbia, South Carolina. And it was amazing and delicious. I drank old fashions all night. So it was good times. But yeah, we were trying to get to find some place to eat. So
interesting. Mr. Goodman, I would have liked to have been along for that ride, but
it was quite fun.
Yeah.
All right. But that's what we're here to talk about movies both past because of 2010 and 2011 movies too, right?
Sounds about right, Mr. Goodman.
Yeah.
And I want to let everybody know that if they wanted to contact us, they can always email us at flicksofdoom@gmail.com or they can tweet us twitter.com/flicksofdoom, and that's FLIX. And you can also subscribe in iTunes and please leave us a review. For this and more, you can always check out our official website, geeksofdoom.com. And I want to let you guys know the reason our own Eve of Doom is not here, Empress Eve, is that her and Dave 3 from Geeks of Doom are on a nice little vacation to Disney World. So they're going to be there for a week.
A well-deserved vacation, I might add.
Yeah, I've been seeing her tweets lately. Looks like she's been having fun over there. So Eve, hurry up back and bring me my mouse ears, and we'll see you when you get back. Mr. Goodman is here to discuss the top five films of 2010. Each of us are going to give our top five. So I'm going to start off with you, Mr. Goodman. What were the five best movies of 2010 for you?
Well, there's still a couple I haven't seen. 127 Hours was not released around anywhere where I live, nor was Blue Valentine. And I think those would have probably made the top 10 list in some capacity. But we're only doing top five, so that doesn't matter a whole lot. But there were a couple of films for 2010 that I wanted to see that I did not get a chance to see. But as far as my top five goes, and this isn't necessarily this is my favorite movie. It's just five movies from 2010 that I really enjoyed. I don't really like to put them in sort of a numerical order.
Yeah.
With like, this is the first, this is the one I like the most, this one is like the second. Although there is a movie that from this year that I would say is my favorite movie from the year. All of these movies that I'm going to list are all great, but I don't like putting them in an order, a specific like first, second, third, fourth order. Starting with number five, it's going to be Toy Story 3, which I really, really enjoyed. I thought it was a really nice way to close out the series. Close out the trilogy of movies. It was a third movie that was actually very, very, very good, and I think I enjoyed it more than the second one, and I think it was a really nice way to close out this really big chapter with these really, really great established characters, even though it was the plot a little very similar to previous Toy Story movies, with sort of different aspects of it tweaked and changed here and there. It doesn't take away the fact that those characters and that story were so engaging to me, and hit me on such an emotional level that I loved every minute of it. And I cried like a girl, and I loved every minute of it. And it just it had a really, really deep emotional impact on me. So Toy Story 3 was my fifth, or was, you know, is in my top five at number five.
Yeah.
Number four, I would have to say, was A King's Speech. I saw this a couple of weeks ago, so it's still pretty fresh in my mind. I really, really enjoyed the movie. I think the performances in it are absolutely unbelievable. And had The Fighter not come out this year, I think Jeffrey Rush would absolutely be a lock for a best supporting actor win, but I think Christian Bale has him beat there. But I think this is the year that Colin Firth finally wins for best actor. It's been a long time coming. I think this is finally the year that he gets it. He's unbelievably amazing and really, more than anything else, really like the way that the movie was shot. The lighting and the cinematography, I really, really enjoyed. And there's not a whole lot of, there aren't a whole lot of sets in the movie. It's sort of, most of the movie takes place within, or not most of it, but a good chunk of it takes place in the doctor's office, or, you know, the speech therapist that, it's that George VI is working with Jeffrey Rush. And it gives this really intimate feel to it. And I really feel like you're seeing this relationship between these two men grow and prosper over the course of the film. And you're really getting a really intimate and personal look into who these two men are, and really a look into what the weight of being a king, especially at a time when the world went through a lot of great changes during World War II. So King's Speech is definitely one that I also highly encourage everybody to go see if you haven't already. Justin, did you ever get around to checking that out?
Yeah, I actually saw it December, like early December. So yeah, that was one of my favorites as well.
So I'm down to three now. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Number three is Black Swan. And I went and saw this not really having any familiarity with Darren Aronofsky. I haven't seen Requiem for a Dream. I haven't seen The Wrestler. Just going off of pretty much the hype on the movie alone and what I had heard about it. And it took me for this incredibly fascinating journey, which, I talked about how personal I thought A King's Speech was. Black Swan takes that and takes it to this entirely different level. It's a coming of age story in a different way than what you think. It's really about this girl, Natalie Portman, really becoming a woman and getting in touch with the darker side of her personality, and with that darker side, getting in touch with her sexuality and getting ready for this performance of a lifetime, which culminates in this really, I think, beautifully, artistically perfect ending to a story that is gripping and fascinating and really haunting from start to finish. And I love, love, love the cinematography in this, in Black Swan. I love the, there are so many angles that are just over her shoulder, and it very close and very tight and on Natalie Portman and Mila Kunis and all the other characters. And it just feels, there's something consistently unsettling throughout the entire film. And I like that feeling of sort of being on edge and building this tension. And then, like I said, the ending, I think, is one of the most perfect endings to a movie that I've ever seen, and found it that it was this just really great emotional journey to the point where I was almost physically exhausted at the end watching it because of just this emotional roller coaster that we have been through throughout the movie. And if you haven't seen it already, you really shouldn't even be listening to this podcast, because you need to run out and go watch it right now. That's really how much I enjoyed it. So Black Swan, number three. Number two is Inception. And what can I honestly say about Inception that hasn't been said anywhere else? You know, I think it's the fact that in the summer, where we normally get such blockbuster movies, we got a movie with such originality of Inception, and the way that Nolan just creates this universe and creates this world with these characters and this really fascinating and intriguing story that has caused tons of speculation. Justin, we talked about this movie for weeks and weeks and weeks after it comes out, and we still talk about it, and people are still talking about it now. I think people will still be talking about it as it continues, you know, as we move on. I don't think, for the next couple of years now, I think Inception will always get mentioned in film critic circles. I like the fact that we're, like I said, in the middle of the summer, we were able to get a movie with such a high concept like Inception. Not that it's really that sort of a highbrow concept, but for a summer blockbuster movie, I certainly think it is. Just a really, really great movie that I, more than anything else, was just a product of the old style, I think, of Hollywood movie making, where there's not a whole lot of special effects. It's all done with just really great camera work and by directors and people that just are really masterful at the art of filmmaking, whether it's, you know, Nolan or the cinematographer or even the actors involved. Just from top to bottom is an outstanding movie.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think my – and I did say I had a favorite movie of the year, and my favorite movie of the year far and away is The Social Network. And when I heard that, you know, they were making a movie about Facebook, I never ever would imagine that, A, I would like it as much as I did, and B, that it would be my movie of the year, a movie about Facebook. But for me, it just – the movie resonated with me on such an incredibly personal level. That's why I think I appreciate it more than the rest of these four other movies that I've mentioned. There was just something about the movie, whether it was Aaron Sorkin's dialogue, who I love the way that Sorkin writes dialogue. He has this cadence and this rhythm to it that it's just – it literally makes me excited to just whenever I find out that he's writing something. Just the way that he writes dialogue is honestly like nobody else, and it's beautiful just to see to hear his words brought to life by people like Justin Timberlake and Jesse Eisenberg and Andrew Garfield, who all had outstanding performances in this movie, and even Armie Hammer, you know. And I think this movie really launched helped to really bring a lot of these actors that had just been sort of talked about and whispered in cult circles, really brought them to the forefront. You know, Andrew Garfield, people had no idea who that was outside of the fact that he was going to be the kid that played Spider-Man. And now I think he's a household name for a lot of people. And same thing with Jesse Eisenberg, who I really think this separated him from being that guy that was like Michael Cera or looks like Michael Cera to, you know, I think he's an outstanding actor. And I think a really great breakout performance for Justin Timberlake too. You know, looking to take his acting career a little bit more seriously, this is certainly the place that you do it. And it's a movie that was just beautifully shot and directed and written. And the score is fantastic. It's my favorite music of the year. You know, favorite movie score from the year. And it's just from top to bottom an absolutely outstanding movie. So, like I said, I'm a little bit biased because I have such a personal connection to Social Network. But that is my favorite movie of the year. So Justin, I'm eager to hear what yours are.
Well, I have a lot of similar selections as you. There's two that we can swap out in place of the ones that you had and the ones that I had, but we are very similar along the same lines. So I will mention Black Swan at my number five. I also loved Darren Aronofsky and just the psychological nature of it. And it also reminded me of American Psycho, which is one of my favorite movies of all time, but a kind of a female American Psycho. So I really enjoyed that aspect of it. And just like you, the ending I thought was absolutely perfect. The soundtrack was pretty good as well. My number four.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. My number four, I'm going to go through these pretty quickly so we can have time to discuss the main movie we saw this week and the news. So I'm not going to say too much about these. But How to Train Your Dragon was my number four. Best 3D experience I've ever had in my life.
Yeah. Sorry to kind of jump all over you there. I would agree. I didn't see Toy Story 3 in 3D. But even with Legends of the Guardians, which was the other real big 3D movie, yeah. Oh, that and Tron. But the way that they did the 3D in How to Train Your Dragon was unbelievable. And it's a movie that really, I think, can go toe-to-toe with Pixar as far as, you know, best animated movie of the year. And as much as, you know, I would not be disappointed at all if How to Train Your Dragon wins best animated feature this year.
Yeah, this is the first time that I've liked a DreamWorks picture more than a Pixar movie. So that's – this year is kind of strange for me. But I also loved the score. You know, of these top five, you can place four of them as my favorite scores or soundtracks of the year. So that is interesting as well. Scott Pilgrim versus the World is my number three. I love Michael Cera. Yeah. I love Edgar Wright, one of my favorite directors. His visual style and his editing at that such a frenetic pace. Just, I absolutely loved everything about the pop culture mashup that was Scott Pilgrim versus the World. Also one of my favorite soundtracks of the year. And The Social Network was your number one. I would place it at number two. I loved everything that you said about it. And I think I liked Armie Hammer's performance maybe the most. As the more I think about it, the more I fall in love with his performance in that movie. So I'm really looking forward to see what he does next. Social Network on my top scores of the year. And my number one, Inception. When I saw it, I said, there's not going to be a better movie for the rest of the year. And I still hold that Inception is my favorite movie and the best movie of the year. But I think when it comes to the awards season, the Academy Awards, I think it's going to be between Social Network and King's Speech, maybe even True Grit.
Yeah, I would agree. I would not be surprised. I think for the first time in a long time, we're going to see Best Director and Best Picture. That relationship between Best Director and Best Picture will not be directly. Normally what happens is whoever wins Best Director normally wins Best Picture, and I think it'll be vastly different this year. I think Nolan's going to win Best Director, and I honestly think True Grit or A King's Speech or even Social Network will end up winning Best Picture. But I think either Nolan or Fincher has to win Best Director this year. But that's where sort of – I mean, the Golden Globes are, you know, right now while we're recording this, they're essentially getting ready to get started. But, you know, Academy Awards are still a little while away. We've got time to speculate and talk about that. But I think the Academy Awards this year are going to be really, really interesting.
Yeah. So those were my top five. Very similar to Mr. Goodman, but I just switched in How to Train Your Dragon for Toy Story and Scott Pilgrim for King's Speech. Although King's Speech is on my top 10, if we were to expand it a little further.
Yeah, and Scott Pilgrim's on my top 10.
Yeah, so I really enjoyed 2010 as a whole. I know a lot of people I've talked to did not like 2010, but there's way too many things I loved about 2010. And if you go down my honorable mentions list, I've got about 15 movies. And like you, there's still stuff that I haven't seen that I want to see. There was some fantastic documentaries that came out this past year.
Yeah.
With
Exit to the Gift Shop is fantastic.
Yeah. I also liked The Tillman Story, Inside Job, and Cool It, and just some fantastic documentaries that came out this year. And even there were movies that weren't on my honorable mention list, but I thought they were just good films. They just weren't on my honorable mentions or top 10. Yeah. So there's just a lot of love for 2010 for me. And I'm looking forward to 2011, although I was actually just listening to an NPR podcast where they were talking about the things that are coming out in 2011. And I'm not as excited as I was, I guess, yesterday before I found out all the things that are coming out. But there are five comic book / superhero movies coming out this year. So I'm hesitant because we're going to reach a point, I think, it's where it's going to be saturated. And number one, there's not going to be any characters left to do. But number two,
we're going to reach a point. I think it's, and I don't want to step over you. I think maybe this is just because, Justin, we run in the circles that we run in. I'm starting to get very, very, very kind of over the whole superhero thing. And it's really just starting, honestly. And I mean, this year there are five superhero movies, like you said, alone. And it's just, I'm kind of starting to already get a little tired of it.
Well, I think the next step is just going to be comic book movies, not superhero, but just like Cowboys and Aliens. And there's another couple others that are coming out. We saw last year with Red and those type of movies where they're based on comic books.
Ass.
Yeah, but they're not. Well, that one does, I wouldn't say, because that's kind of a superhero, but I'm just comic book properties that aren't based on superheroes.
Yeah.
I think we're going to be seeing more and more of those and stuff that people would not associate with comic books. But I'm still looking forward to 2011. And speaking of, we're going to be talking about one of those superhero / comic book sort of movies, and that's The Green Hornet. So we'll be talking about that in a little bit. But first, let's get into the news of Doom. All right, Mr. Goodman, these are some topics that you had brought to my attention that you wanted to discuss. So let's go into the news of Doom. All these stories can be found on geeksofdoom.com. The first one is the Ridley Scott Aliens prequel, which I talked to some people who didn't even know that existed or that was even being talked about, is now no longer going to be a prequel. You want to tell us more about this, Mr. Goodman?
It's not even going to be related to the Alien series at all. It has since evolved and turned into its completely different own monster. Ridley Scott had been potentially, like you mentioned, was looking at possibly making an Alien prequel movie. And since then, it's really turned and morphed into this whole monster called Prometheus, which is going to have Ridley Scott directing and Damon Lindelof writing the script. It started out that Lindelof was rewriting the script, and that Ridley was possibly going to present a storyline that showed the alien creatures from the classic 1979 horror movie that were actually genetically engineered as weapons. And it turned into this other movie, like I said, now called Prometheus. Noomi Rapace, who was the she's the star of, and I may probably mispronounce that. She's the star of the Swedish adaptation of The Girl with a Dragon Tattoo, who Fincher will bring to theaters later this year, with Rooney Mara starring in the lead role of Elizabeth Slaughter. But she's going to be playing a scientist character named Elizabeth Shaw, and they're also speculating that Angelina Jolie and Charlize Theron might be interested in a role, and that more of the casting will be announced soon. But Ridley, this is going to be the first sci-fi movie that Ridley Scott has directed since Blade Runner. And there's a little bit of details here. This is what Scott had to say. While Alien was indeed the jumping off point for this project, out of the creative process involved a new grand mythology and universe which this original story takes place. The keen fan base will recognize strands of Alien's DNA, so to speak. But the ideas tackled in this film are unique, large, and provocative. I couldn't be more pleased to have found the singular take I've been searching for and to finally turn to this genre that's so close to my heart. And there's a quote here from Lindelof, too, but I'll let you go on to Geeks of Doom and read the story for itself, because it's really interesting. And I'm really, really excited for this. I'm really, really excited to see not only Ridley Scott come back and take adapt a sci-fi movie, but to see what Damon Lindelof is going to do with this script that was – you know, essentially this alien script. And last time we saw a similar situation to this was the collaboration between Peter Jackson and Neil Blomkamp with the Halo movie, which then turned into District 9. Mm. And if we can get something that good out of this collaboration, I'm really excited to see what Prometheus could be.
Yeah.
It won't release until 2012. I actually specifically March 9th, 2012, but still something to get excited about early on in this year.
Mm-hmm. Now, were you a fan of the Alien franchise before this?
I have not seen any of the Alien movies. Wait a minute.
You haven't seen any of them?
I have not seen any of
them. What?
I meant to go back last year when I watched Avatar and go through all of James Cameron's movies. I never got around to it, but I know things about Alien from pop culture, and I know it's something I need to see. I'm just a little bit apprehensive because I know it is a horror movie of sorts, I'm not particularly keen on horror movies, but I know I need to go through and watch it just because of I'm a sci-fi fan and the contributions Alien has made to the sci-fi genre. You really can't overlook them, and I feel like as somebody that likes sci-fi, it's sort of essential viewing.
I also like how each movie in the franchise kind of is a different genre almost. Like the first one, like you said, is a horror movie. The second one, James Cameron took over and turned into an action movie. And then the third one, Fincher took over, and it's more of a nihilistic type apocalyptic future. I don't know how to describe it. And then we won't even talk about the fourth one. But still, you should at least watch the first three in the franchise, especially the first one I think is by far the best entry in the franchise. So yeah, very much I am looking forward to this because of the people involved. I'm a huge Damon Lindelof fan, and it sounds to be sounds to me like something that I will be interested in as well. So I'll be looking forward to Prometheus.
Yes. On in some really, really exciting news, the 23rd James Bond movie has finally been saved from development hell and is going to see Sam Mendes direct the film, who he had been rumored to direct the film, but now he's officially attached. And Daniel Craig will return as James Bond. And the fact that this movie was possibly not going to be released still baffles me, because I think James Bond, especially what they did with the Daniel Craig relaunch with Casino Royale and Quantum of Solace, it was going to be a damn shame if the Bond series did not continue. Because I think the Bond movies are one of those things that it's just an essential part of film culture at this point, the Bond movies. And but the brand new Bond movie will be released on November 9th, 2012. So we've got a little while, but it's coming, and that's more details than we had earlier, you know, than we had last year when it was sort of still being rumored to not exist. So,
yeah. Now, do we have a director yet?
Sam Mendes.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to this. I was not the biggest fan of Quantum of Solace, but I was a huge Casino Royale fan. So,
yeah,
I'm looking forward to this 23rd one. Hopefully, they can get back on track at least a little bit more. What did you think about the last Bond movie?
I liked Quantum of Solace, I think, more than some people did. Mm-hmm. It definitely was not as good as Casino Royale, but I didn't think it was terrible. Considering the fact that most of the James Bond movies that I grew up with were the Pierce Brosnan ones. Mm-hmm. And I think when you watch a movie like Die Another Day, you really can't do worse than that. As much as I love Halle Berry and as much as I like Pierce Brosnan as an actor, that movie was just snow igloos, ice casinos, ice hotels. There comes a point where you're just kind of like, okay, this is just too ridiculous. And I thought Quantum of Solace did a good job of still being grounded in that more realistic world that had been created with Casino Royale. And I like the fact that it was sort of, there were plot points from the first movie, Casino Royale, that carried over into Quantum of Solace and drove the plot forward for that movie. Mm-hmm. And so I like that, and I hope that some of that carries over to Bond 23. But I'm glad more than anything else that we're getting a Bond 23, because like I said, if this film franchise were to die, I think it would have been an absolute travesty.
Yeah. All right, so we'll see what happens with the 23rd Bond movie. Mr. Goodman, we talked about the comic book movies.
Yes, we did.
Mm-hmm. And one that's coming, we're going to talk about two right now. One that's coming out this year and one that's coming out next year.
Yes.
Let's first talk about the Marvel, they're both Marvel movies.
They are both Marvel. Well, one's a Marvel Studios movie, another one is a Marvel movie.
Yeah. This one is going to be coming out this year, and that is Captain America.
Yes.
We saw a picture of Chris Evans as Captain America. So
yes.
Both of these pictures, as you know, my spoiler policy, I don't like to look at pictures or trailers before the movies, but with both of these pictures and with the Thor picture that came out with Chris Hemsworth, I glanced at them. I did not focus on them. So
right.
I kind of got, I mean, I already know what both of the actors look like. So to me, it's like seeing them in the costume to me is not the biggest of deals. But what did you think of when you first saw Chris Evans as Captain America?
Well, I mean, the costume, I think, first and foremost, it looks great. But it also looks just like those concept art pictures that were released around October, November of last year, maybe even September. But it's Chris Evans actually in the suit. And it looks great. They absolutely nailed sort of the Ultimates look of Cap's suit. It feels more of – he looks like a soldier more than he looks like a superhero, which is good because he's a super soldier who eventually becomes a superhero. But I like the fact that it looks like it looks like a military uniform, but that they've taken aspects of it and changed it into this iconic Captain America costume that that the people in this world, this Marvel Universe world will come to know and understand. And, he looks great in it. Chris Evans looked fantastic. There were a couple of set pictures that were released earlier. Not earlier, but were released last year as Steve Rogers. And he just looks fantastic. And this is just a continuation of that. I know I was certainly a little apprehensive about Chris Evans being Steve Rogers when it was first cast. But the more and more I learn about this movie, the more excited I get for it, to the point where I'd really always been really, really anticipating Thor. But now Captain America, my anticipation for that is rising and is almost equaling Thor in terms of my anticipation. And so, yeah, Chris Evans looks absolutely great in the costume, and I want to see a trailer, and I don't want to wait till April for it. I would like it now. So hopefully we will get that trailer sooner rather than later.
Yeah. And someone else that was spotted in a suit, Mr. Goodman.
Yeah.
As we talked about earlier from The Social Network, Andrew Garfield.
Andrew Garfield, Sony Pictures decided to finally release the first official picture of Andrew Garfield as Peter Parker in costume, minus the mask, but it is a sort of it's a little ominous image of Andrew as Peter Parker with his head down walking the street with a little blood stain or scar on his cheek. In this new Spidey outfit, and it looks very similar to the Tobey Maguire Spider-Man outfit. There are little aspects here and there that are changed, but one of the things that you can notice if you look very closely at the picture is that it looks like there are web shooters on his wrist, as opposed to it looks like he will actually have web shooters this time around, as opposed to having natural organic webbing. I think Andrew Garfield looks great. And this is also one of those movies where the more and more I hear about it, the more my anticipation grows for this movie, whether it's Dennis Leary playing Gwen Stacy's father or, Martin Sheen playing Uncle Ben and Sally Field playing Aunt May. The more and more I hear about it, I'm really, really looking forward to this, and I really wish it was coming around this year. And I buy Andrew Garfield as Peter Parker more just based on looks more than I do Tobey Maguire as Peter Parker. Andrew Garfield is 27 years old, but he still looks like he's a kid that could be in high school. Whereas I never really quite bought Tobey Maguire as somebody that still looked like he was in high school.
Yeah.
And I don't know if I'm the only person that felt that way.
No, I think there are a few people who also shared that feeling with you, but I think this one is a little more different than you have. I think the MTV splash page pointed out 5 noticeable differences between the 2 costumes. And the biggest 2 were like the one you said with the web shooters, or what looks like web shooters, or some type of silver disc, which I'm hoping that is not web shooters, because I don't want a repeat of the 70s Spider-Man television show where the web shooters were on the outside of his costume. And the webbing itself, which is on his costume.
Yeah.
On the Tobey Maguire costume, the webbing looks like it was glued on the outside of it. This one, it looks like it's all one piece of fabric. So that's what I like about it.
Well, and there are a couple other go ahead.
Oh yeah. That was the end of my thought.
The actual spider design looks a little different. It's not so much silvery this time around as it is black. As far as the V part of the red on the costume, it doesn't come all the way down and doesn't have sort of like that red spider belt on it that the Tobey Maguire suit has. Mm-hmm. And even on the cuffs, like the upper wrist part of the gloves, there's sort of streaks in it. Like it streaks a little bit. Dane, who's my co-host over at Between the Panels, made this comparison. I think it's a pretty apt one. It reminds me a lot of what if Nike made like a Spider-Man outfit. It's very sleek and stylish, and while very similar to the Tobey Maguire suit, it's different enough that it will stand out and I think be able to be taken on its own merits. But it does look very sleek, and I like it.
Hmm. Yeah, it remains to be seen. I'll see it in the movie context. Right. I also want to see the mask because I don't want them to go in a vastly different direction, because I've seen, I think, concept art where the eyes were black and some other things. So I'll be interested to see how the mask fits in with the rest of the costume. But also, I was talking to a friend of mine the other day, and I was saying the thought occurred to me after this picture was released that it looks strange to me with him with his mask off, because Spider-Man is a character that we're used to seeing with his mask on. Mm-hmm. And same thing with Batman. I remember the Michael Keaton Batman Returns where he rips the cowl off somehow. Like it's like some weird type of rubber that's easily rippable, which I don't know why it would be that easy to rip it. But Michael Keaton's face looked weird with the Batman costume. Same thing with Tony Stark Robert Downey Jr. and Don Cheadle in Iron Man 2, seeing their faces on the characters' bodies just looked strange to me, the proportions of it.
And right. Well, you've got these big, huge hulking suits of armor and then just their faces. It is a little jarring, but I don't think it's quite as jarring here.
Well, again, I was going to – the other thing I was going to say was, but if you contrast that to characters that we're used to seeing, think about Superman. It doesn't look weird to see Superman's face with his costume.
Right,
so,
right.
That was just a thought that I had in my head the other day. It was kind of weird.
Yeah.
But yeah, it remains to be seen. We'll see what happens. And obviously, at some point in the movie, he's going to have his mask off.
Yeah.
And he's going to be in the costume. So
yeah,
we'll see what happens there. But I am very much looking forward to the Spider-Man reboot, not only because he's my favorite comic book character, but Mark Webb's involvement in Andrew Garfield and Emma Stone and whoever else they end up casting.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's just been and I still don't really understand the necessity of having another Spider-Man movie. But I am comfortable with all the, I think the choices that I've made so far have been definitely good ones. If you're going to recast it again, I don't really see the necessity of relaunching it all over again, but I think as crazy 2011 is going to be for comic book movie releases, 2012 is going to be even more ridiculous with, you know, The Dark Knight Rises, the next Superman movie, Spider-Man, The Avengers, I think is the Wolverine supposed to be due out in 2012?
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah. You think 2011 is going to be ridiculous, 2012 is going to be even more absurd. Yeah.
Well, and that goes back to my point. I never did finish my thought on that, but I'm skeptical and weary that with all of these comic book movies coming out, the general audience is going to get tired of them. Mm-hmm. And there's going to be a backlash and people are not going to come out to see superhero movies because, as usual, Hollywood is going to beat it into the ground until it does not make any more money. As long as it's making money, they're going to continue to push out comic book movies, whether they be sequels, reboots, or going to the 10th level characters that nobody has ever heard of except for us.
Right.
Being comic book fans, I should say. So that's what I'm worried about, is the comic book superhero becoming too overexposed and too saturated. So we'll see what happens there. But you guys can always see what happens over at geeksofdoom.com, where you can read all these news stories and more. But let's talk about the movies that came out this week, Mr. Goodman.
Yes.
I saw The Dilemma, so I'll just briefly mention that. It's Ron Howard's latest movie, starring Vince Vaughn, Winona Ryder, Jennifer Connelly, and Kevin James. So it's an all-star cast. Queen Latifah is also in there for two scenes, literally about 1 minute of screen time. I'm not sure why Queen Latifah's in it. And the only reason she's in there is to mention two jokes about having Lady Wood, which were hilarious, and I laughed out loud, but her character almost had no point besides that. So I was very disappointed by why was Queen Latifah in there at all. I will say overall, I enjoyed The Dilemma. There was a lot more dramatic and serious moments that I was not expecting. Oh, Channing Tatum is in there as well. Speaking
yes.
of stars and Channing Tatum, every time I see him now, I just think about how he was rumored to play Captain America. And I was thinking about what would a Captain America movie be like with Channing Tatum. And I don't think I would like to see that movie, although I do like him as an actor.
Yeah.
But yeah, he was okay in this too, playing kind of the... well, let me go back into the actual plot of the film real quick. The Dilemma is Vince Vaughn catches his best friend's wife cheating on him. And should he tell his best friend and ruin kind of the... They're up for a huge meeting at work and he has to be focused on his job. So should you tell your... Now, this is actually an interesting thing, Mr. Goodman. I'd like to ask you, if you were faced with this dilemma, would you tell your best friend that his wife was cheating on him right before the big, you know, let's say in a sports terminology, right before the Super Bowl, right before the big game? Or would you wait until after the Super Bowl to tell him? Or would you tell him at all? Or like, would you just go straight to the wife and say, you know, I know what you did. You need to fix this. If this is a problem in your marriage, you need to work it out. You know, you're hurting my best friend. So what would you do, Mr. Gibbon? I'm interested.
Well, I mean, since you put it in terms of like the Super Bowl, mm-hmm. I don't know what I would do. It is a dilemma. I certainly probably wouldn't go to his wife. And who of is played by Winona Ryder, correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Yeah, I probably wouldn't go up to his wife and mention it about him. I would probably tell him. If he's my best friend, I definitely feel like he has a right to know. But I think he should work his merit. He should try and he knows his wife better than I would. So I think it's up to him to mm-hmm. determine how he would deal with it. But I absolutely think he has a right to know. And I don't know if I would necessarily want to tell him before a big event. I'm just trying to figure, I'm trying to get more context. Am I on the team with him?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Well, then I would probably wait.
All right. Yeah, because that's basically the scenario. Vince Vaughn, he and Kevin James are trying to sell an electric engine to a big car company. And it's an electric motor, but it sounds like, you know, you get the big beefy sound of a muscle car. And that's kind of like the holy grail of, you know, everybody wants this big loud engine and, you know, to be a man, but also be environmentally friendly and gas, you know, saving money, that all that stuffed into one. So that's basically what's going on. And Vince Vaughn actually ends up telling the wife, going to the wife, Winona Ryder first. So it's kind of an interesting dilemma. So that's, I did enjoy that, seeing that. And there were moments that I laughed at. There were, and which I always judge a comedy by how much I laugh at it. So there were moments where I was laughing out loud, but I don't think the movie ever truly comes together as a complete narrative and funny movie. It's interesting. Ron Howard, I have a lot of respect for as a director, and this is his first comedy since Ed TV back in 1999.
Wow.
So it's been a while. I love Vince Vaughn. Kevin James, I like, but really, this is one of those movies. And, you know, with the Green Hornet, Seth Rogen, and the dilemma, both Vince Vaughn and Kevin James, and a couple other movies I've seen recently, I've kind of come to the conclusion that with a lot of these comedy actors, they're basically playing themselves to a certain extent, or their character, you know, or their shtick. Like, I recently saw Jack Black in one of the worst movies of the year last year. What was it? I'm blanking on the name of it now.
Gulliver's Travels. I am so sorry.
He is doing the exact same thing he's doing in School of Rock and every other, you know, Tenacious D, I love metal and all this, the same type of character. And I came to the conclusion, like, I hear a lot of people say, you know, this person's shtick is getting tired or this person's whatever, you know. But then I also thought about, we recently saw Jim Carrey on Saturday Night Live, and a lot of the stuff that he did. Now, I've loved Jim Carrey since I was in third grade when he was on In Living Color. And a lot of the stuff that he did in Living Color, on Ace Ventura, it was coming out in that what he was doing on Saturday Night Live. And I thought about it and I was like, you know what? I love that in the 90s, but now in 2011, I'm not necessarily as keen on that. But it's still kind of the same performance. And so a lot of these actors, I'm starting to realize they're doing the same thing that I guess what people fell in love with and what continues to make them money is to play the same character. Although you also have people like Robin Williams or there's another comedic actors that do a serious turn or take as well. And they do a lot of dramas. And I think those type of actors have more longevity in their careers rather than doing the same thing over and over again. But it also, it just depends on whether you like that. Or actually, Zach Galifianakis is another one. He did recently a comedy and a drama in the same year, and he's sort of stretching his wings a little bit more rather than doing the same thing over and over again. But a lot of these films, I think it just depends on whether you like that or not, what the particular actor is doing. And that's why the actors make the big bucks, because that's what draws in people. I'm going to see the latest Adam Sandler movie. I'm going to see the latest Vince Vaughn movie. So
right, you talked about that overlap of like their routines playing in their movies. I think Zach Galifianakis is an interesting case, to the point where word for word, some of his jokes from his stand-up are lines that are in movies. And things that he does. But yeah, there are, and I can't remember anything specific right now, but there are several jokes in The Hangover that are direct quotes from Galifianakis's stand-up. And it's the same thing with Due Date, like the whole corn dog on a nude beach. Mm-hmm. That's one of his stand-up jokes. So I think Zach's a really interesting case. But yeah, I think it's really difficult for all comedy. I think comedy is like that in every single case. I think the times where you get really fresh comedy is where you get these people, for instance, like Jon Hamm, who aren't necessarily comedic actors.
Oh, yeah.
Who are known for other roles, and you put them in a comedic situation, I think, and then it's sort of surprising that, oh, this guy is funny, and mm-hmm. you're able to see a new, fresh take on comedy. But we're sort of – when you have established comedians, they do have a tendency to fall into their same routine.
Yeah. You know who else is like that? John C. Reilly. He was known for dramatic roles before he was in Step Brothers and Talladega Nights. And it's interesting because Talladega Nights,
really?
Yeah, he was a serious dramatic actor before that.
Wow. I had no idea. When I saw John C. Reilly, he just looks like he's a guy that was always born to be a comedian. There's some people that you can tell are always supposed to be comedians, mm-hmm. and John C. Reilly, I've always felt, was one of those people.
Yeah. But Talladega Nights was the first real – I mean, I guess I had seen him in other things before that, but like I saw The Aviator. I didn't see Gangs
of – He was in The Aviator?
Yeah.
Wow.
I didn't see Gangs of New York or Magnolia, but see, he was in things like that before Talladega Nights. And Talladega Nights was the thing that I really got, that was the first thing I really saw him in. So I thought he was just a comedic actor. And then he did Walk Hard. He was the Sasquatch in the Tenacious D movie. So he was doing a lot of comedies. But, you know, recently with this year, we saw him in Cyrus, and that... Did you see Cyrus last year?
No, I haven't. I think I've got it like on Amazon. I may have rented it or something.
Yeah, make sure you check that out because that was a fantastic movie. And apparently, I'm looking at his IMDb, he was an uncredited bathroom zombie in Zombieland.
Yeah. Awesome.
But with Step Brothers and Walk Hard, he's been doing a lot of comedies lately. But with Cyrus, it's not a typical comedy. I think it's more of a dramedy. I would say it's a drama with comedic elements in it, and he's definitely not playing the bumbling fool kind of role that he had been playing, like Dewey Cox, in Step Brothers. So he's an interesting person, like Jon Hamm. I would say that he's gone back and forth between those two, and I actually listened to a Film Spotting interview with him. It was very interesting where he could tell, I guess, how old people were based on what they yelled out at him when they saw him in public, whether it was they yelled out something from Dewey Cox or Step Brothers, or whether it was something from his, he's credited in 63 things on IMDb.
Wow.
So he's had a long career. He was in Chicago and a number of things. So, Days of Thunder. That was another one that he said people yelled out things from Days of Thunder to him. So yeah, he's another interesting person like that. But with Zach Galifianakis, again, he was in Dinner for Schmucks and Due Date last year, but he was also in It's Kind of a Funny Story. And so, and also, you know, he had that small role in Up in the Air, but he's kind of someone that I don't think necessarily plays himself in every single role. But with Vince Vaughn, I think he's pretty much played Vince Vaughn, and Kevin James the same way. So you either like those guys or you don't. And I really love Vince Vaughn. Like I don't know how to describe him. He has a certain cadence and a way of talking that makes me laugh. Just he has kind of a rapid fire delivery, and the jokes are coming at you a mile a minute, and it almost takes you a little while to process it. And but once you get it, then you know you're hysterically laughing on the floor. His last two movies, The Breakup and Couples Retreat, haven't been the shining examples of his career, although I liked him in both of those roles. But in this one, I enjoyed Vince Vaughn being Vince Vaughn, and he really does steal the show. Kevin James is in it as well, but he doesn't really shine as much as Vince Vaughn. Vince Vaughn kind of, through the strength of his personality, takes over for everybody in the cast. And that includes Winona Ryder and Jennifer Connelly as well, who they gave okay performances. But to me, this is like a Vince Vaughn vehicle. If you like Vince Vaughn, you're going to like The Dilemma. If you don't like Vince Vaughn, you're not going to like The Dilemma. So that's kind of where I stand, excuse me, on that. But I had a lot of fun with it. Hans Zimmer is credited as doing the music, but I could not pick out any...
Yeah, I saw that in the trailers, and I was like, what?
Well, Hans Zimmer, I noticed he does a lot of these type of things where it's not like an Inception or like a Dark Knight, where it's what you typically think of Hans Zimmer as being. Mm-hmm. It's just like a typical movie score, like a romantic comedy score. Like you don't think about the music, but Yeah, I don't know, Hans. This is one of those things. Apparently, this movie was very expensive. Estimated at some places I've seen $70 to $75 million, and it made, or it looks like it's going to make about $17 to $20 million. So they're looking at it as a huge flop this weekend. Kind of sad because, as I said, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the performances, but it just didn't come together quite nicely in a complete package for me. So I would recommend a rental for The Dilemma. And also, actually, another thing I was thinking about, the chemistry between Vince Vaughn and Kevin James isn't quite as strong as, I would say, something like with Vince Vaughn in The Wedding Crashers with Owen Wilson, or Kevin James in I Now Pronounce You Chuck and Larry. I thought him and Adam Sandler had a pretty good chemistry, as well as one of the worst movies of last year. The Kevin James, Adam Sandler, Chris Rock, David Spade, Grown-Ups. That the chemistry between Adam Sandler and Kevin James and Grown-Ups was pretty good as well. But in this one, I just didn't feel that they fit together that nicely. So again, a rental for The Dilemma. And now let's move into a film that we both saw this weekend, which it looks like is, at least with the estimates, is going to be number one at the box office this weekend.
Yes.
And that is The Green Hornet.
Yes.
And The Green Hornet, as I kind of maybe mentioned a little bit earlier, that it's a comic book movie or based on a comic book. The Green Hornet is kind of an interesting character. And this movie is interesting as well because there's a long history of how this movie came about. And I would definitely recommend everybody check that out. If you look up, I'm looking it up right now. I'm sorry. I'll get you the link in a second. But it's had a long and arduous road between production and rewrites and Stephen Chow being director and then leaving. And he was going to play Kato at one point. And there's a whole bunch of things. This movie got pushed back, and then it got up converted to 3D, and there was a whole long story of how this movie got to the silver screen. That's interesting. And also, the character itself of the Green Hornet is kind of interesting because it started out as a radio program, kind of like Zorro or the Lone Ranger, which the same guy who created the Lone Ranger created the Green Hornet. And he also had a television show created by the guy who did the Batman, Adam West TV show in the 60s. And that is the most famous iteration of the Green Hornet. And it's not even because of the Green Hornet. It's because Bruce Lee played Kato, the sidekick. And that's how I knew about the Green Hornet. Was I was a huge Bruce Lee fanatic when I was a little kid. I still love him to this day. But Kato was the reason why I think everybody loved the Green Hornet in particular, was because of Bruce Lee's personality and charisma. And so we fast forward to 2011, which this movie was completed last year, but again, pushed back and back and back. And Seth Rogen and his buddy, his writing partner, Evan, I think is it Goldsmith or Goldsman? Either way.
Yeah, one of the two.
Yeah, he is the writing partner. So he and Seth Rogen came up with the storyline and decided, oh, let's put Seth Rogen in it. And let's also cast Cameron Diaz in a throwaway role. I don't know why she's in the movie, because you could have put any actress in that role.
Well, who's more of a throwaway? Edward Lee Olmos?
Edward James Olmos, yeah.
Adam James, yeah. Sorry. Yeah, I got confused.
Yeah, I forgot Edward he James. Was even in the movie.
Yeah, like that's the thing is I saw a report from Splash Page. It's like Edward James Olmos was like, wait a second, he's in the movie? Like they didn't promote that at all. Yeah. And I'm just like, wow, I literally had no idea he was in there.
Just to update you, Evan Goldberg is the writing partner. So yeah, so basically the story of the Green Hornet, it's kind of an update. At one point, Kevin Smith was attached to direct this movie, and he wrote a script, which I won't get into it, but I'd rather have seen that movie. And if you want to actually know what that script was, you can buy the Green Hornet comic book that has come out. It's now out in hardcover, written by Kevin Smith.
Is that
Smith.
Even good?
That I will say it's better than this movie. And so that gives you a little, you know, I would recommend you checking that out, Mr. Goodman, because it's got the Kevin Smith. Oh, and it's got a female Kato in it, which is kind of an interesting touch. Hmm. So yeah, check that out if you're interested. But this movie, as I said, the Green Hornet was a 1930s radio program, and it's lasted through the years. But it's one of those products like The Lone Ranger, which we're going to be seeing a Lone Ranger movie as well, Mr. Goodman.
Yeah, Disney's doing it.
It's one of those type of products that people know about it kind of in the pop culture, but who was actually clamoring for a Green Hornet movie or a Lone Ranger movie or Zorro movie?
Not me.
Yeah. So I'm interested, Mr. Gumoon, what was your experience with the Green Hornet?
Well, I think much like the television show, my favorite part of the movie was Kato.
Yeah.
And I think Jay Chou, who's kind of like the – I think he's from Taiwan, but he's mm-hmm. huge in China. And from what I understand, he's kind of like the Justin Timberlake of China.
Yeah, because he's a pop singer.
Yeah.
Which is strange because I was thinking about how did they cast this guy? How did they – like, oh, well, let's go take the Taiwanese Justin Timberlake and let's put him in this movie. Also, not to be confused with John Cho.
IMDb.
Who they originally – if you guys don't know John Cho from Harold and Kumar and Star Trek, you will recognize him. I also saw he tweeted – John Cho tweeted, oh, I guess I'm not in the Green Hornet. So there was some confusion about that, which is very strange to me, especially IMDb. You know, you figure IMDb is kind of a – they have higher standards. But anyways, they got it wrong.
They done goofed.
There was a funny post that Dave Chen put up over at slashfilm.com all about that. So if you can Google that. Continue with your thoughts on the Green Hornet.
I mean, like I said, I think much like the television show, Kato is definitely the best part of the film. I've read reports that Michel Gondry, who directed the movie, and I forgot to mention him.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Sitting on my shelf, like waiting to watch Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
Oh, no,
but I've seen some of the music videos and stuff that he's done. When I found out that he was doing the movie, it really confused me. And it really sounds like he did not have a whole lot of creative control over the movie.
Yeah.
It sounds like Sony and Seth Rogen really, and Evan Goldberg, it really had a lot more the final say of what did and didn't make it into the film.
Oh,
and
by the way, did you happen to check out the Jimmy Kimmel episode?
I did. I watched it today. I watched the intro that he did, and it made me want to go watch Eternal Sunshine even more, which I think I'm going to end up doing that tomorrow. But
yeah, that is a fantastic movie. He's also known for The Science of Sleep and Be Kind, Rewind, which I was not a big fan of Be Kind, Rewind, but I do love Eternal Sunshine. That is one of my favorite movies.
Yeah, and I like visually what Gondry brought to the film. I think Kato Vision was amazing. That seems
to be the standout. What everybody's remembering about it is the Kato Vision.
Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt you, but...
No, go ahead.
I didn't understand why Kato was able to see things the way he was.
Yeah, they never really give you any context other than the fact that here's this guy and he's really awesome and this is the reason why he's awesome, but we don't... Well, I mean, he kind of says he's like... I can slow – when my heart beats fast enough, it slows down time. And then Seth Rogen kind of – there's kind of a line that's almost like a throwaway line. He's like, I don't understand how you do it, but you just do it and you're able to do it. And then Seth Rogen can do it at the end, and there's really no context for that either other than the fact that his blood rate gets really going and then he can do that. And then I like the sort of – the way that they play with your expectations there, and then it doesn't fully work out like he kind of ends up missing out before. But I mean – I'm not a huge fan of Cameron Diaz, so I didn't like her in the movie to begin with.
Yeah.
I thought they did a pretty good job of making her less annoying than she normally is. Mm-hmm. I didn't find myself absolutely hating her in this like I do pretty much everything else that I see her in.
Actually, you know what I was surprised about? I'm not a big Cameron Diaz fan either. The only thing I've ever, number one, found her attractive in, and number two, liked her in, was the first Mask movie with Jim Carrey. Other than that, you know, I didn't like her in Charlie's Angels, didn't like her in anything else she's been in, and her face kind of annoys me as well. But I did find it interesting that they pointed out her age in this movie, which is not something normally an actress, number one, is you know, signs up for to be poked fun at, kind of being an older woman. But the way that Seth Rogen was trying to say it, in, I guess, in a nicer term, but it didn't come out any nicer, that made me laugh. So I just thought that in particular was interesting because I was also thinking about that while I was watching the movie. I was like, she seems a lot older than both Seth Rogen and Kato, which I looked it up and she's 10 years older than Seth Rogen, which surprised me because I'm 2 days older than Seth Rogen, which I did not realize. But also Jay Chou is, or Chu or Chow, I'm not sure, but Kato.
I think it's Jay Chou.
He is 31 and she's 38. So it was an interesting thing. Normally don't see that type of age difference, at least from male to female. Normally you see it the other way around, female to male. But yeah, I just thought that was interesting.
Yeah. If I was Christoph Waltz, I don't know if this would necessarily be the second the movie I would want coming out post Inglourious Basterds.
I wouldn't. And you know what? I wish they would have. He was really over the top and zany in this movie.
Yeah.
I kind of wish he would have been maybe the grounding factor, the anchor. He would have played it realistic as a
villain. Well, he is for most of the movie. And you brought this up in you know, your video review that you did after spoiling that James Franco was in it. Thank you.
That was the best part of the movie.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, it was. But it just takes the last third of this movie takes this really weird turn, and it kind of loses me. Like, you know, I can understand sort of the strife between, like, you know, between buddies, but it happens in like every like every comedy movie ever. Is like that last. So it was just, it was really predictable there. I was like, oh, they're gonna get back together, you know. But just like the stuff that Chinofsky decides to do, Bloodnofsky, and that stupid, whether it be the red in my mask or the blood in your eyes, the last thing you will see is red. I was like, good God, this is just terrible. And I don't know. It's just, yeah, like I was really down with the first two thirds of the movie, and just the last third kind of lost me. But I, you know, it's still really entertaining, and I wasn't going into this really expecting anything else other than to be entertained, and it did that. You know, it was entertaining, but it's, and I definitely think it will be the most fun that I have in some of the dump months movies. But in the grand scheme of things, and even the larger superhero movies of this year, it's going to get lost in the shuffle pretty damn quick.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I've heard that argument a lot, where, which is interesting because this movie has received a lot of mixed reviews, where some people loved it, some people hated it. And the people who loved it, I'm seeing a lot of the, well, it's good for this month and it's a lot of fun for January. And,
which shouldn't be justification for why you give it a review. Like, if this movie had come out in November, like, it came out in November. Like, it's don't use a dump month as an excuse. I mean, and this is coming from somebody that kind of just did that, I realize. But,
well, yeah, that's kind of why I brought it up, because I was thinking about it. I'm agreeing with you. I don't think that's a good justification for saying it's a good movie because it was or good movie for January, because
for January,
after January, you're never going to think about that again. When it comes out on DVD, most people are not going to go back and look up, oh, when did it come out? January 2011. Oh, okay. Well, that makes the movie better because it came out in January. Like, you're not going to think about that. So that's, I'm trying to myself stay away from saying things like that in the future and just trying to judge the movie for what it is and not even for when it's released.
Even if it came out in the summer, like, it would still have the same complaints with it. And I would probably still say the same things that I've said. I'm just saying the fact that it came out in January will not play into my overall scoring of the film.
Yeah.
I wanted to sort of, I guess, provide a bigger context for,
you
know, normally, typically things are out, that come out in this aren't normally entertaining, something like this. But even if it come out in the summer, because, you know, there can be some months in the summer that aren't, or weeks in the summer that aren't particularly great releases. Like the week that Takers came out. Like, you easily could have put Green Hornet out on that same week. Like, and
that kind of surprised me why they pushed it back, because it was originally supposed to come out in the summer, and then it got pushed back to like January, or I'm sorry, December or something like that. And then it got pushed back to January. So I'm not sure. Did they need that time to do a bad 3D up conversion? I'm not sure.
And that's the other thing, is I didn't see it in 3D.
Okay, good. Because I went to a movie screening and a press screening, I should say, and it's only available in 3D. So
yeah,
I saw it and I knew it was up converted from the start. So
which is part of the reason why I didn't want to see it. And coming out movies this year, the only one that I know so far that's been filmed in 3D is Transformers.
Okay.
Out of all the big like summer 3D releases.
So Green Lantern is not shot in 3D, is that correct?
No.
Okay.
Green Lantern, Captain America, and Thor, I believe, will all be up converted. Although when I was at Comic-Con and I saw the 3D preview for Thor, the 3D certainly looked better than any of the up converted stuff I had seen that year. Like Alice in Wonderland, and there were a couple other ones, you know, that were up converted ones that I saw in 3D. The 3D in Thor looked better than it had in those. But I still will probably not go see Thor in 3D.
Okay.
Nor Green Lantern, nor Captain America.
Well, the thing is, I think the more time they have to produce it, I thought that makes it a better 3D experience because...
And sometimes it does.
Yeah. Like,
but I don't...
The biggest thing we looked at this year was... Or I'm sorry, in 2010 was Clash of the Titans and Last Airbender. And both of those were rushed 3D jobs. Whereas something like Piranha 3D, I thought a lot of the 3D worked in that one that was up converted.
Was it filmed in 3D?
No, it was not. Because it was...
Really?
There was some problem with the water, like
right, well,
with
that
the 3D
that
cameras
sense.
Around the water or something like that. They had a lot of problems. So most of it was up converted, but that looked okay to me. Maybe I had low expectations for it. I don't know. But it did not look as bad as some of the other ones we saw. And
yeah,
the Green Hornet, it was one of those type of effects where if you remember the old little ViewMaster toys uh-huh. that you would look into and you would click it and it would go to a next scene and it would be kind of... The background is separated from the foreground, like they're two
yeah,
different objects.
Yeah, I don't like that at all.
That's what it looked like in this, where you could clearly tell it didn't seem like there was more depth to it. It seemed like they were separate objects, like almost like you were on a green screen, like the actors were not there in front of the background because it was so separated.
Well, so, yeah, was that just because the backgrounds were so – and the backgrounds are – they're so static that the characters just moving causes just the backgrounds to look like there's no – motion, and it, I think, does that create that sort of jarring separation effect?
Yeah, I'm not 100% sure, but mm-hmm. I know it just did not work for me overall.
Right.
And a friend of mine who I went to see the movie with, he pointed out that, and I didn't even notice it until he pointed it out, Seth Rogen's nose, for some reason they chose...
Even in 2D, some of that stuff is just really like, you can tell they're when they do just focusing things, uh-huh. like the aspect ratio would almost like change mid-shot. Mm. And there was one something where, and just like his nose just looked like, Seth Rogen's nose just looked like really, really big in one shot and then not so much, like 2 seconds later. I don't know, it was kind of weird. I would imagine in 3D it was even worse.
Yeah, in 3D, his nose, it was like Pinocchio. His nose was popping out at you in 3D and it just looked very strange. So that was interesting. But now, speaking of like the dilemma being a big budget movie, the Green Hornet, the estimates are between $125 and $150 million.
Good God.
I'm sure most of it went to the cast, but the weekend box office right now, they're estimating it at $34 million. So I would say probably with the worldwide gross, it'll probably make its money back, but still there's a lot. It seemed like it was a lot more expensive than what we saw on the screen, maybe?
Yeah. I would agree with that. I mean, they do, you know, a lot of the car sequences are really good, and I think that's because the producer of the film was involved with the Fast and the Furious films.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that looks good, and, you know, I like the little kernels they threw in there, like the fact that Kato's notebook has a drawing of Bruce Lee in it.
Yeah,
like, I thought that was a nice touch.
I cheered when I saw that, yeah.
Yeah, I got excited for that, you know, and I like the fact that James Franco's there in the beginning, but... You know, they're just – and there are parts of the film that are really entertaining. And then there are just other parts that it's kind of like very, very groan-induced.
Yeah. And that's that's what I felt about the dilemma. Like there were flashes of brilliance, but came together as a complete experience for me.
Exactly. I would absolutely agree with that.
Yeah. And it's disappointing because I was – you know, I had heard – first of all, I had heard things about – Sony not liking what they saw when they were first shown this film, and also the fact that they had pushed it back, and the fact that they were releasing in January, the fact that it was up converted in 3D, all of these things were not playing into me getting excited about it. I was excited for Michelle Gondry, Seth Rogen, and yeah, pretty much those two were the two things I was excited about because I'm not a Taiwanese pop fan, so I don't know Jay Chou at all. But yeah, that was the things I was looking forward to. And it was a nice surprise to see Edward James Olmos. Tom Wilkinson was another one who he has had a long and illustrious career. And the aforementioned James Franco, who anytime he makes a face, I just start laughing. I love his performance in anything he's in. And music by James Newton Howard was all right. I don't know if I would necessarily buy the score, but it was all right.
Yeah, and I mean, I like the Black Beauty. Like there was some review I read that, you know, it almost gives the Tumblr run for its money, which mm-hmm. I kind of agree with. I mean, door guns are really cool,
mm-hmm.
And you know, so I think, like you said, and I know I'm kind of just not kind of I am repeating myself here, here. But there are these absolute flashes of brilliance. And it's a shame that those don't just come together in a more cohesive fashion, because I think it had the potential to really be something really, really neat and sort of maybe almost be like the Kick-Ass for this year, where it kind of comes out of nowhere. And it's this really entertaining, exciting look. But at the end, there's this whole moment where Seth Rogen is talking, when he's pitching the idea of a Green Hornet, he's like, well, we don't want to fall into the cliches of being superheroes. But at the end of the day, they fall into the cliche of a superhero movie.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
I don't know. I think this is part of my overall larger problem with superhero stories and origin stories in general, is that Thor is going to be very similar to Iron Man, which is going to be very similar to Captain America, which, it's just an origin story, but with a different character and a different setting and different aspects. And I don't want like another origin superhero movie.
Well, you know, what's interesting about Thor is that because I didn't think about this until I was listening again to that NPR podcast I was telling you about, where they were talking about the movies coming out this year. With Thor being a god,
It won't be so much of an origin.
Yeah, he doesn't really have an origin, but I found that kind of interesting because I didn't even think about it. Going back to this movie, Green Hornet, and the production problems that it had, did you know at one point Nicolas Cage was in talks to play?
Yeah, I read that somewhere. I think it was maybe on Deadline, and I was like, oh. But then again, I wasn't particularly sold on Seth Rogen as Britt Reed. And maybe that's just because I don't –
Well, you know what else?
My patience for Seth Rogen. Seth Rogen is starting to turn into Jack Black for me.
Well, again, that goes back to what I was saying about those comedic actors. And I saw that in this movie again. And, for me, just like Vince Vaughn, I like Seth Rogen and I like what he does. So that kind of played into what I like. But at the same time, that's not actually the character of Britt Reed. So it's kind of hard to – I mean – for people who don't know the character and have no affiliation to Green Hornet, this will be what they think of when they think of Green Hornet. And it's kind of like, let's say, think of Bruce Wayne, and then think about the way that Seth Rogen played Britt Reed. That's kind of an analogy you can use, but yeah, it's just, he's not the character that you had grown up in, let's say, the 1930s radio program or the television show. And it's also interesting because I remember hearing that he lost a lot of weight just to play the character. Like, he was really serious about playing the role. And I remember when he hosted Saturday Night Live a couple of years ago, everybody was kind of shocked at how much weight he had lost. But then when we see what the final product was, I don't know if it would have been any different if he had played the overweight superhero. I don't know. Like, right. It's still, there's a lot of, it's not as much, it's more comedy than it is action to me.
Right.
It's like an action comedy. And that's kind of a different take on the superhero, like the comedy, and that's, I saw some comparisons to Kick ASS because of that, being a lot more comedy rather than superhero and action. And some people like that. Like I said, it was very mixed results on a lot of people. They had a lot of fun with it. They thought it was funny. But some people had the opposite reaction. Like the friend that I went to see it with, he didn't like Seth Rogen's character and found him very unrelatable. He thought he was a jerk and didn't like
him. Yeah, and I would agree with most of that.
Yeah.
But that was when Kato and him have that bonding moment where they're like, oh, my father was such a dick. It's like, well, you're not exactly like a super great person either. And Kato comes to find that out over the movie, and then they work out their differences. But it's like, you're really not that much better. I related to Britt Reed and Seth Rogen more at the end of the movie, but it took a while. And I'm still not even fully convinced that I'm really on his team.
Yeah. Another thing I thought, this movie had a lot of odd chemistry.
His side, rather. His team, I don't like males' the preference there.
Oh,
yeah,
yeah.
Team. Yeah.
I thought there was a lot of odd chemistry in the movie between Seth Rogen and Jay Chou, between Cameron Diaz and both male actors. I would say even between Seth Rogen and Michelle Gondry. There's just a lot of things that it didn't seem like it came together and formed one cohesive narrative or cohesive movie.
So, I think this is a classic case of too many cooks in the kitchen, and
Yeah. Actually, you know, this movie goes back to 1992. If you're talking about that long road, and I said I was going to give you guys the link here. So actually, let me pull this up here real quick before I forget. It's, if you want to Google this, Float Like a Franchise, Sting Like a, and it's a NewYorkTimes.com article. So just Google that and you'll find the long road to this movie being made. But yeah, it goes back to, and at one point in 2000, Jet Li was going to be Kato, and there was going to be a lot of all kind of stuff. But yeah, so at one point, Jake Gyllenhaal was going to be the lead, which I don't know, maybe that could have worked. Who knows? Off in another dimension, maybe that movie is great. But you mentioned Kato, and as I thought he was okay. I think I liked him less than you did. I still have Bruce Lee in my mind when I think of Kato.
Right, and I don't, because I never watched the Green Hornet television show.
Yeah.
So maybe that's why I think, you know, yeah. I mean, you just voiced your opinion on that. And I think had I grown up watching, or had I seen any of the, you know, Bruce Lee Green Hornet, for lack of a better way to phrase that. And
that's really,
I enjoyed Kato less.
Yeah, that's the first time I can really think about a sidekick outshining the main hero.
Well, and that gets played in sort of the essential theme of the movie is you know, Britt Reed's trying to, he's like, oh, I'm the Green Hornet, but everybody's like, but his sidekick is so much cooler.
Yeah.
And he does, like, he pretty much does all the work while the Green Hornet is just sort of the mouthpiece almost, which is really how everything, you know, like I said, the entire movie plays out. Kato pretty much does everything, and Seth Rogen kind of just sits there and takes all the credit for it.
Yeah. I will recommend, Mr. Goodman, you check out, I'm sure it's on YouTube. I haven't looked this up, but I'm sure there's a way to find the Batman Green Hornet crossover episode.
What?
And you can see Robin fighting Kato and Batman fighting Green Hornet. You
that know, sounds awesome.
That typical, oh, the first time the heroes meet, they think the other is a bad guy, and then they fight, and then they join forces and team up against someone else. But you got to see that. And there was a Bruce Lee documentary that I used to watch over, and it was on VHS as a kid. I used to wear it out. I watched it so many times, but it was funny because they were interviewing all these people and they were saying in that episode, it's the most unrealistic thing because Robin beats Kato, and everyone was like, Robin would not last 2 seconds with Kato. So yeah, it was an interesting documentary. And I would recommend again, checking out that episode because it is campy, but it is campy fun.
That sounds like it is the most ridiculous thing ever, and I need to watch it right now.
Yeah, probably. I'm sure if you just Google Batman versus Green Hornet or something like that, it'll be in there. But I think overall, we both had a similar experience with the Green Hornet.
Yeah.
Some of the jokes I enjoyed, the comedy, there are flashes of brilliance and a lot of interesting, I think, Gondry visuals and shots. And actually, I don't know if you had a chance to check it out, but the AV Club did a pretty good video review where they showed you kind of, you could see the influence of Michel Gondry's earlier music video career,
mm-hmm.
where he did this video with the White Stripes, and it had that effect of multiple, like the Kato Vision where the cars extend out.
Yeah, where the cars extend. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a White Stripes video where they did that with the drums, and the Kato Vision is interesting, and there are a lot of interesting visuals, and there are moments of brilliance, but to me, I think there are those flashes and moments don't overcome the flaws of the movie for me. I think Christoph Waltz was wasted. I think Cameron Diaz was wasted. And you know what? Another thing I was just thinking about, some of the violence made me, I'm not sure how to exactly put it, but
like they kill a bunch of guys and they don't really ever come back to it. It's like, there's just like, well, he's dead. And there's really, it's just.
In particular, there's one time where the police are chasing them and they flip a cop car.
Yeah.
And I'm like, did they just kill that police officer?
And they're kind of like laughing about it, like, the cops. And it's just like, wait a second. Like, I know you're supposed to be the bad guys, like the good guys pretending to be the bad guys, but they don't even like try it, stop to like recognize it at all. Like, oh, crap. Maybe we killed that police officer. They're like, we're going to shoot a missile at a traffic cam.
Yeah. Yeah. So that just kind of made me stop and question it. Oh, and speaking of those, you know, them going out and fighting crime, one of the meth dealers, I don't know if you noticed this, but I saw his face and I was like, wait a minute, is that Edward Furlong who played the young John Connor in Terminator 2? And it was the meth dealer. that they you know, that goes to Christoph Waltz's character.
And yeah, yeah.
That was Edward Furlong. So very interesting. His career has been kind of strange. I haven't seen it. I haven't really seen him since Terminator 2 as John Connor, but yeah. So that, just wanted to throw that in there as well. And if you see this movie, now this is another one I would say rental, because like I said, yeah, there are flashes that I think it's worth seeing at least once in your lifetime. But if for no other reason, watch it for James Franco's face. That's all I got to say there. So, Mr. Goodman, overall, your thoughts out of 5?
3 out of 5.
And I'm going to give it a 2.5 out of 5. So, kind of right in the middle there. But, yeah, it's getting a lot of, like I said, kind of mixed reviews on, in the critical circles. There, it's got a 44% on Rotten Tomatoes. And I'm pulling up the consensus now for everyone, if I knew how to spell tomatoes right, which I don't. But I'm going to continue to spell it the way that I want to.
Tomato.
There it goes. Let's see. Green Hornet has a 43% right now. The Dilemma has a 25%. The critical consensus out of 160 reviews, and they kind of agree with us here, it's sporadically entertaining, but the Green Hornet never approaches the surreal heights suggested by a Michael Gondry-Seth Rogen collaboration. So yeah, I think both of them, you know, with Seth Rogen with things like Knocked Up and some other things that he's done, 40-Year-Old Virgin, and even going back to his TV days, I still want to watch Undeclared and Freaks and Geeks, but I've heard he's fantastic in those. I think a lot of these guys have done better work outside of this, so the collaboration, it seems like it would have, or would have, or should have wielded more. That is going to conclude this week's Flicks of Doom. I'd like to thank you for joining us, everyone. Thank you, Mr. Goodman, for joining us.
Thank you. Mind if I go ahead and pull up some stuff here? You can read my review of The Cape, in which I tell you that The Cape is no Dark Knight. which, in retrospect, was not the best way to start off that review. But where I pretty thoroughly just ripped The Cape to shreds. There will be more television content coming soon. There will be a review of Lights Out, the pilot episode of Lights Out, in the next couple of days, with the second episode of Lights Out. Mm-hmm. And I'll be covering Archer here when that premieres on the 27th of January, and a couple of other shows. Look for that. We're also doing some winter TV primers, and I'll be taking a look at the return of Parks and Recreation this Thursday in part of that series. Keep it locked at Geeks of Doom for all of your television content headed up by yours truly.
Yes, and Geeks of Doom is the place you want to be, Mr. Goodman. Also, for all of our listeners, please check out our Twitter page, twitter.com/FlicksOfDoom. Email address, FlicksOfDoom@gmail.com. Both of those are with an X, F-L-I-X. You can always subscribe to our show on iTunes if you're not. It'll be delivered to you whenever there's a new episode released. And for subscribers, you actually get the episode before it's posted on geeksofdoom.com. So that if you are in a hurry to listen to my voice or Eve's voice, you can go ahead and do that and subscribe in iTunes. You can also leave us a review there. And check us out next week when I think Eve will be back. I don't know. Maybe she might get stuck in the Magic Kingdom and not want to leave. So we'll see if Eve wants to leave the happiest place on Earth. But until next week, again, thank you to Mr. Goodman. Thank you to all of our listeners for listening. And
you've just been stung.